$25.
There's not too much left. And then I drove a cab in New York. So I joined the union. Of course, at one point, labor was 34% of the population.
Yes.
Back in the day. Now we're down to 7%. 87 million Americans did not vote.
Yes.
What does that tell you? Apathy and complacency. Pacifica is the only station that really gives out the true voice of this country.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sona Ali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech, TV, and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sona Ali Kohatkar, host and executive producer. This week, we'll examine the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, a war launched without congressional approval that has already killed hundreds of children, and Iran's top leadership sparking a wider war in just days. Kaveh Ehsani, Associate Professor of International Studies at DePaul University, will be my guest. Then we'll go to Cuba to speak with Havana-based journalist Ed Augustine to ask the question of whether the Caribbean island will be Donald Trump's next military target, and how the people of Cuba are surviving decades of U.S. sanctions. Finally, best-selling author Steve Phillips joins me to discuss the Reverend Jesse Jackson's legacy of multiracial political organizing and why it remains so relevant today. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. The Iranian Red Crescent Society is reporting that nearly 800 Iranians have been killed in U.S. and Israeli airstrikes since the Trump administration launched an illegal war on Iran on February 28th without congressional approval. Among the first targets of U.S. and Israeli bombs was an elementary girls' school in the southern Iranian city of Minab, where 175 people, most of them children, were killed. An Al Jazeera investigation has concluded that the strike on the school was most likely deliberate. The U.S. and Israel's airstrikes also resulted in the mass extrajudicial assassinations of Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei and most of the nation's top military commanders. Iran has retaliated by aiming drone airstrikes at U.S. military bases located in neighboring Gulf Arab nations, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Iraq. Donald Trump, who had proclaimed himself the so-called peace president, has, in typical fashion, contradicted himself and said that the Iran war could last weeks or a lot longer. My guest is Kaveh Ehsani, Associate Professor of International Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He is a contributing editor of MEREP, the Middle East Report, and sits on its board of directors. Welcome to the program, Kaveh.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
So, first of all, we had expected that the U.S. would attack Iran. There were a lot of threats being made. And the airstrikes launched February 28th. You and I are speaking on Tuesday, March 3rd. a lot has happened in just a handful of days, including a spectacularly large number of civilian casualties and the wiping out of Iran's leadership. How have you been feeling through all of this as somebody who studies what's happening there? I imagine you have family there. Give me your initial thoughts on this war that threatens to destabilize the entire area.
Despondence. I mean, it's, knowing and being aware of the history of similar conflicts in the region, for example, you know, Iraq, Libya, you know, Afghanistan, Syria. The future looks really bleak. This is, you know, this will have devastating consequences in the long run, not just for Iran, but internationally. So, you know, there's nothing to feel good about, in this process. But, you know, the worst thing is that this war will probably put an end. It will probably fail to kind of achieve one of its stated goals. I mean, there are like at least half a dozen supposed stated goals that have been uttered by the Trump administration. But, you know, one of them is regime change. I don't think it will lead to that. The Iranian political leadership or the regime is pretty well established. It has supporters. It has a military infrastructure. It controls the economy for better or for worse. So this will not lead to that, to any kind of like regime change. But it will lead to greater repression at home, more pauperization of the Iranian population. And contrary to one of the other aims that, is claimed to be, you know, the purpose of this war, it will not lead to, you know, grassroots democratization from within Iran. If anything, it will really set it back.
Now, wasn't the United States, or at least some diplomats from the United States, weren't they involved in negotiations over Iran's nuclear weapons? I mean, of course, this is a years-long project that saw most progress under the Obama administration. But even under Trump, I understand that before this war was unexpectedly launched, that there were some negotiations happening, right?
Yes. This is the second time. You know, back in June, also there were negotiations, in the middle of which Trump administration joined Israel's attack, you know, unilateral attack on Iran, unprovoked. Same thing happened. They were in the middle of negotiations. Trump was issuing ultimatums saying, you know, within 10 days, within 2 weeks, within the next month, you know, within the next few days, you have to completely capitulate. And I don't think any state will capitulate to arbitrary demands that are being piled up. You know, first it was Iran's nuclear program, you know, like scaling it back. Then it was like giving it up completely. Then it was about Iran's nuclear, ballistic missile, capabilities, on and on and on. So negotiations were never serious to begin with. International law has never been a factor that has been counted in, you know, in this equation, in this situation. What we're seeing is completely cynical and arbitrary and fly-on-the-pants decisions being made, with huge consequences for Iran, for the United States, for the region, with no clear purpose. There were negotiations, but they were meaningless.
U.S. presidents have often enjoyed launching wars to distract from their domestic problems at home. And on that, we can only speculate as to the reason why, whether it was distracting from the Epstein files or from Trump's, you know, plummeting poll numbers. Well, let's talk about the impacts in Iran. I mentioned the bombing of the girls' school, 175 people killed. The media reports in the United States, at least the initial ones, have been quite biased, claiming that, you know, this is something Iran said happened. And of course, using the sort of passive language that removes responsibility. But Al Jazeera saying that this was likely a deliberate attack, and it happened in among the very first airstrikes. Any explanation that you have as to why the U.S. and Israel would do this, other than just utter carnage?
I don't know. I mean, you know, this is a scenario we've seen unfold across this region. I mean, you know, this is what happened in Gaza, right? I mean, You know, there are all these, targets that one doesn't know why they were chosen: hospitals, schools, museums, and so on and so forth. I mean, there's a claim that, you know, somehow these are like dual use facilities: a girls' school in Minab, a tiny coastal town in on the on the Persian Gulf. Who knows?
And there were no Al Jazeera found no military bases or installations or any reason why this school would be attacked. So either U.S. and Israeli intelligence is completely inept, embarrassingly so, or they deliberately killed civilians, children. It's one or the other, right?
Entirely possible, entirely, or incompetence or whatever. Look, the U.S. war doctrine and Israel's war doctrine have been quite clear since 2000 that the way to pursue war, against an adversary is so-called to kind of push them back into the Middle Ages by targeting civilian infrastructure on a wide scale so that everyday life becomes impossible. You know, like people live in ruin. So, they may not even kind of prioritize military targets or troops, but rather, the infrastructure that makes life possible in a everyday life possible in a society. So once that's gone, any remaining political establishment, regime, military, and all that will be set back and kind of set against its own population because they can't deliver on the very basic necessities of life. So, for example, I was talking, my sister managed to call today. It's very, internet is down, phones are down. Every now and then, if one is lucky, gets a call. And she lives in a neighborhood near north central Tehran. And she said at least six hospitals near their house had been targeted. These hospitals are not military hospitals. They're a heart center. They're an ophthalmological center, and so on and so forth. So schools, hospitals. Governmental offices, municipalities, all of those are being targeted.
So this is Israel's playbook in Gaza?
It has been. I mean, Gaza has been flattened. There's nothing left, in Gaza, as far as we can tell. I'm not sure if that's even possible in a country that as large as Iran. But in the past 2-3 days, since this war started, there's been at least upward of 1,000 targets hit. Have those targets been all military? I very much doubt it. One of them is the school in Minab that you mentioned.
So the top military leadership has been wiped out, along with, of course, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. Donald Trump is saying that the military should simply turn over its weapons to the population. He's also floated the idea of supporting so-called armed Iranian militias. I'm not sure who those are. And it, as you were saying, sounds like he's flying by the seat of his pants. And again, this almost sounds like he is trying to apply the Afghanistan formula to Iran, right? We saw the U.S. come in, say that they were going to save the Afghan people from the Taliban, from these authoritarian leaders, and put their political support behind armed factions. And of course, decades later, the country is back in the hands of the Taliban and just devastated from decades of war. It doesn't sound like there's any such viable option. This sounds like a Trump fantasy, right?
Well, there's there has been, with Saudi support, with Israeli support, with U.S. support, and the significant part of the Iranian diaspora, there's been a revival of the monarchist option as an alternative, which I can tell you has very little base in Iran, as far as I can tell, from accounts that one hears.
You're talking about Reza Pahlavi.
So there's no base, there's no organized base. The notion that Iranian military will just kind of fall apart or switch sides is a fantasy. The Iranian military is divided into multiple branches, and the regular army, which they're counting on, is more or less toothless. It's supposed to be defending the borders, but in terms of personnel, in terms of officer corps, in terms of you know, equipment and all that, is it really takes second place to the Revolutionary Guards, which are in the hundreds of thousands, and you know, they're an ideological force. If there's one coherent support for this establishment and this regime, it's that, you know, together with the Basij militia and, you know, and other kind of clusters of support that they have. So I very much doubt that the Iranian military will fall apart. And let's remember, this is a country that's been at war and has experienced it for the past 40 years or nearly 50 years. I mean, you know, I know from kind of like hearing from people that, you know, since this summer when Israel and U.S. attacked, they've been making preparations. So there's, you know, I mean, Trump referred to, you know, like having taken out like two or three layers of the leadership, which he was also claiming that he is open to negotiation with whoever is the leader, but we've killed them all, you know, so there's nobody.
Right, he literally said there's nobody left,
yeah,
because we killed them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's somebody that's, you know, this is a situation which would be comical, if not so dire. That we have the largest superpower that has given its, you know, all its might, has put all its might into the hands of somebody who doesn't recognize international law, who doesn't recognize any kind of checks and balances domestically. And we have a population in the U.S. that is quite passive, you know, towards this. You know, I mean, there's a lot of tsk-tsk and, you know, like King's Day and here and there, but getting involved in a war like this and causing this kind of havoc on another population is not something that is reflected in everyday lives here until the, you know, the price of gasoline goes up. I mean, this is a sad state of political affairs in the United States. And this fellow, Trump, I mean, he feels empowered and the system is empowering him to continue with this. And there's been the ground has been set for this. I mean, the constant vilification of the Iranian regime, and which a lot of it is true. I mean, I have zero sympathy for the regime in Iran. But you know, if you kind of reduce your political awareness and decision making to, you know, this kind of dualistic bad guy, good guy, and you say, oh, this is a bad guy, then okay, eliminating him, killing him becomes okay. It's actually quite remarkable for a country to go and assassinate another country's leader, or, you know, kidnap another president, and so on and so forth. This means that any kind of rule that we've had since Second World War is in tatters. Any kind of international rules, any kind of international laws, anything that has been keeping, you know, some kind of a semblance of, you know, rule of law on an international basis, however limited, all that is in tatters. And all that matters is brute force and the will to power. You know, so this is the situation we're dealing with. And it's quite despairing. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what we're seeing is the destruction of international law and the absolute bankruptcy of the U.S. political class. And, you know, and I hope at some day we'll see some kind of a reaction here to this, right? Because it will have huge consequences.
I've been seeing reports of Iranians, and Iran is a highly educated country and a very large country. We've seen lots of reports of Iranians posting on social media saying that they are neither supporters of the supreme leadership nor of the U.S. military intervention or war, and that if they die, they will be victims of both these forces. And it's just such a grim message to see coming from a people who have every few years tried in vain, of course, to have a democratically, you know, to have a grassroots overthrow of the regime and been crushed every single time. And of course, if you look at the long view, I'm wondering if you have an opinion on this, Kaveh, does it feel like the more the West has targeted Iran's leadership, the stronger it has gotten at home, because it has been able to claim that it's protecting its people from Western imperialism?
Well, it's gotten more brutal. I'm not sure if it's gotten stronger. It's, you know, it's been losing its legitimacy. And I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, there's been wave after wave of protests in Iran. You know, and this dates back. I mean, you know, this has become integral to Iranian political culture, this willingness to protest and be unafraid despite the kind of increasing, you know, brutality of repression. To kind of voice discontent, whether over environmental issues, you know, pensioners, you know, labor activists, students, women, and so on and so forth. I don't think, you know, there's been awful repression, but it hasn't been all a loss at all. So, for example, the Women Life Freedom Movement, which took place in 2022 and 23, brought about remarkable changes. I mean, you know, effectively, women and their allies managed to actually push back the regime and normalize wearing whatever public dress you want in the street. The laws are still there. Repression is still there. But de facto reality has changed because it's unenforceable anymore. And this was, you know, this rule of hijab in public was an absolute pillar and a taboo for this, you know, for this government. Two things were taboos. You know, one was this. The other one was death to Israel and death to the U.S. And we will not negotiate with them. I mean, and death means like, you know, like they're evil. That we're not going to negotiate with them. All these taboos are falling apart through popular action. So if one thinks that political change will come through miracles, and from one day to next everything will change, that is not the case. But then on the other hand, we have to realize that through people's actions from bottom up, a lot has been gained, and you know that, you know that, and this was an ongoing process. Now, what's happened in the past 7-8 years, which is really kind of important, is the huge impact of economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. That has really truly pauperized the Iranian population. It has really decimated whatever middle class there was, the educated middle class to which you referred to, and if people are kind of struggling to survive and feed their family and you know, keep shelter or even buy basic foods, you know, under these circumstances, you know, struggling for democracy becomes sort of, you know, a luxury. And if there is an explosion of anger, it's so desperate that it just wants to destroy and get rid of everything because, you know, you don't see any future. You know, there is no sense of
right.
future.
And in fact, on that, aren't the retaliatory strikes by the Iranian regime on U.S. military bases around the Gulf region, that's effectively an act of desperation, right? They have nothing left to lose. And this wider war could be the kind of thing, you know, the kind of thing that you can't put back together once it's unleashed. Are you worried? Let's finally wrap up our conversation with your thoughts on the potential for this to spread. Hundreds of airstrikes from Iran, kind of expected, right? A predictable outcome of what the U.S. and Israel have done.
Yeah. You know, we don't have a crystal ball, but we can see from past experience and what is unfolding that, you know, the consequences will be huge. Yes, you know, Iran, it's an existential fight. It's, you know, we'll kill you, so let's kill back. This is what happened in Syria after 2011-12, when there was an attempt to kind of like overthrow the Assad regime, you know, which kind of like ended the democratic grassroots movements, and then everybody else got involved, you know, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, US, name it, you know, they were all participants in that civil war slaughter. So, you know, the repercussions of putting autocratic regimes in an existential bind are quite dire. You know, first of all, you know, it increases the level of domestic violence. It doesn't necessarily dislodge the established, you know, ruling class or regime, but if as misery increases, I mean, if Syria had a population of 20-25 million and, you know, half of that population became refugees, Iran has a population of 90 million, and if life becomes impossible, imagine just a wave of refugees leaving Iran affecting every single neighboring country. If there's a civil war in Iran, which is becoming more and more likely, and ethnic separatism becomes an issue, this will get all the neighboring countries, you know, Turkey, Azerbaijan, you know, Iraq, Pakistan, you know, and these Arab you know, monarchies on the Gulf, you know, in the Persian Gulf, all of them will get involved and will be affected, right? So the consequences in the long run are significant and huge. We can't predict all of them, but you know, because we don't have a crystal ball, but we have seen this scenario unfold before with huge consequences. So that's what we're seeing.
Well, Kabi, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And of course, we'll continue to monitor this situation. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Kaveh Ehsani, an associate professor of international studies at DePaul University in Chicago. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has declared that the U.S.'s launch of a war against Iran will soon be followed by a direct assault on Cuba. The Caribbean island, which had faced the longest economic sanctions by the U.S. against any single country in history, has been crippled after the Trump administration kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and cut off Venezuelan oil sales to Cuba. Trump has essentially deputized U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the son of Cuban immigrants, to oversee regime change in Cuba. We go now to Havana to speak with Ed Augustine. He is an independent journalist based in Havana. His work has regularly been featured in the New York Times, the Financial Times, NBC News, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and more. And he recently helped create a documentary short on how U.S. sanctions impact Cuba's healthcare system. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Thanks for having me.
So as I mentioned, the Venezuelan regime change that the U.S. has essentially engineered had this very direct ripple effect on Cuba. But even before that, Cuba was suffering. Is it fair to say that we're at the point that Cuba is at the point that it is today as a direct result of the U.S. essentially squeezing its government for decades and refusing to allow the island to flourish?
Well, there's a massive ideological effort, well-financed, by the way, by U.S. taxpayers, to try and make us say no to that, to make the answer to that question no. But the answer to the question, from any objective, balanced, serious, analytical point of view, has to be yes. Cuba has been pushed to this point by U.S. sanctions. So Cuba has been sanctioned longer than any other country in modern history. It's been under a US sanctions regime for 67 years, two-thirds of a century. And the sanctions on Cuba are among the most powerful sanctions in the world. The only country that could really compete with that in terms of a target that suffers sanctions is the other country that's really in the international headlines today, Iran. In Cuba's case, it's very, very powerful because the US is Cuba's natural trading trading partner. And yes, right now it's just flagrantly obvious that is the case. I'd invite viewers to close their eyes and just imagine what would happen if a country, most countries are dependent on oil. I understand the US isn't at the moment. But if a country highly dependent on oil, what would happen if a foreign power stopped that oil coming in? If they tariffed any country that wanted to send them oil or sell them oil? If they made military threats to other countries that they would physically stop the oil getting in using their navy? That's what would happen. Well, oil would run out, people would panic, prices would go up, the price of food would go up, there'd be more hungry people, food production would go down because you need petrol for tractors, the food that you're producing would rot because it wouldn't get to market quick enough because you need lorries. And once it gets to your house, if you're lucky enough to buy it, having walked a long way to get it at a high price, Well, how are you going to keep it refrigerated? Because refrigerators rely on electricity, and in a huge amount of countries in the world, that means oil. So, as much as we don't like it, the fact that many economies are still dependent on oil, and as important as the green transition is, the reality is, the sad reality is that most of the world's still dependent on oil. And it's inevitable whether or not the government is a good government or a bad government, managing the economy well or badly. All these are irrelevant points. If you can't have oil coming in, then your economy is going to collapse very quickly. And with it, the living conditions of the population. So hunger is going to rise, infant mortality rates are going to rise, more people are going to die, less people are going to go to school. The society will fray and collapse. The inevitable, the only honest answer to the question of whether or not all socioeconomic indicators are rapidly deteriorating in Cuba because of US sanctions, the only honest answer is yes.
Now, the Obama administration had begun to ease sanctions against Cuba. When Trump came in, all of that went out the window. But also, it seemed that there have been back channel pressure being put on private companies and governments around the world to deny Cuba sales of all sorts of things, from food to medicine. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but most of the time the sanctions are so powerful that they don't even have to apply any extra pressure through diplomatic arm twisting. They do it, right? So the obvious example right now with pressure is Mexico. That I understand Claudia Sheinbaum, one of the reasons why her government that last year sent Cuba a large amount of oil as humanitarian aid, I understand one of the main reasons that she decided to stop sending oil was, first, threat of tariffs from Donald Trump's government at the end of January. But secondly, because they're intimidated and they don't want to get into a confrontation with the Mexican Navy and the US Navy. And the US has had in January deployed the biggest show of military force in the Caribbean since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. So that's a threat. The US is also making threats against other countries, particularly in the Caribbean and Central America. So that the countries kick the doctors out, and the doctors are there to help people in many cases that have never seen a doctor. But they're also there to try and get some money for the Cuban state so that the Cuban state can buy food and can pay the doctors and can import energy, sorry, petrol, and can build solar farms, etc., etc. And a lot of threats have been made to smaller, weaker countries. So, for example, this year, the US, sorry, last year, the US sanctioned officials in a load of Latin American countries, including Brazil, if they receive Cuban doctors, if they have Cuban so-called medical missions there. That's a threat. That's carrot and stick. Another thing they do, or that they seem to have done, is to threaten small Caribbean countries that are very dependent on US aid, that that aid will cease. Or that they'll be hit by tariffs if they don't kick the Cuban medics out. But in terms of how the sanctions work, and I don't use the word embargo, I use the word sanctions because an embargo is just if one country decides not to trade with another. But the US sanctions is a broader regime of coercion that pressures third countries to cease trading and investing with Cuba. So embargo doesn't capture it accurately. The main way in which that works is basically tying companies up in knots. You don't need extra diplomatic pressure because the sanctions legislation you've got creates a situation in which the banks take fright. As one executive in a small boutique, they called it pharmaceutical firm in Europe, told me last year, for the companies, Cuba's a small island, it pays late, but added to that, you get in a you could potentially get in a lot of trouble. And legal problems for even selling it, even something as basic as medicine. So that's the way in which this system strongly dissuades
Right. Now,
trade.
the US has been, bandying around this word terrorist to describe basically anybody that it wants to attack, including Iran, including Venezuela, and of course, including Cuba. But it was only recently that a boat that carried 10 people from the United States, Cuban men from the United States, armed with assault rifles and handguns, basically attempted to invade Cuba and were thwarted. And still, the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself said, quote, Cuba has taken extraordinary actions that harm and threaten the United States. There seems to be zero evidence of any such thing. He sounds like he's just basically making it up. And I think you would agree.
Do you think that they'd take it seriously if other countries said that by defending yourselves from people that are shooting at you in your own waters, you're a threat to international security? All you need to do is run it in reverse to see how absurd it is. In terms of terrorism, yeah, it's just a cheap label, isn't it? In international politics, you know, our enemies, we call them terrorists because it works a little bit better. Cuba is not a threat to the United States. Don't take my word for it, take the Pentagon's word for it. The Pentagon was asked in the 1990s by Congress whether or not Cuba constitutes a threat to the United States. The answer categorically was no. But interestingly, they said that there's only one scenario in which it could become a threat. And that's if there's disorder on the island that leads to a mass migration event to the United States. That could then become a threat.
Are you worried that the US will actually wage war on Cuba? I mean, an air war, air strikes, ground troops? It just seems inconceivable, but so did an actual war against Iran. And that's well underway with 500 plus Iranians killed already, including 165 people killed when a girl's school was struck.
Yeah, I remember reading that news. I was reporting yesterday for the Times, the article just came out today, about this, about how Cubans are increasingly becoming scared of a US military attack, right? Because on the 3rd of January, the US abducted Nicolas Maduro and 32 Cubans died in that special operation. And they were there guarding Nicolas Maduro and they were killed by the US. And so it's been that's very personal for a lot of people because it's Cuban blood that was spilled. Now we have Iran. The Trump administration looks emboldened on foreign policy right now. It feels that it's very confident. And yeah, one former Republican military analyst who's very good said to me, yeah, you know, as soon as Ukraine is kind of under control or they've got a deal there, once Iran is out of the way, if it is, then they'll come for Cuba. Trump's gaze will turn. People are scared. The people I spoke to living in a very poor community by military base are scared of airstrikes and being hit. A friend of mine told me this haunting story. He's somebody that lives in that community. His wife is 7 months pregnant and they live 50 meters away from this military base, just a small like military outpost. But it's the sort of place that would conceivably be hit, right, in an air attack. And he said to me a couple of weeks ago that he was talking to his wife and they were wondering out loud whether or not if there was an airstrike on the base next to them, if they die or whether the front part of their house would kind of protect them. And so they're thinking it through. Again, she's about to give birth. And then my friend just said to her, this is insane that we're even talking about. This is surreal. So I hope that brings home the fact that this is on people's minds, normal people's minds, poor people's minds. Personally, I famous last words to predict what the Trump administration is going to do, especially with Marco Rubio, first ever Cuban-American Secretary of State, very hardline, very warmongering, would do. Personally, I think it's unlikely they're going to go for a military attack. Their theory of change is very clear. It's a medieval starve them out approach. You know, they got Venezuela. They now control Venezuelan oil. No oil is being sent to Cuba. They coerced and scared Mexico into stopping sending oil to Cuba. That's most of the country's oil gone. And so they think now it's only a matter of time until what they see as this evil regime collapses. What often gets missed, I think, in US administrations and US media is that the Cubans have been there before, and they've been there before a long time. And if you speak to people, people just shrug their shoulders and say, what are we going to do about it? That's our lot in life. If they say they're looking for an interlocutor, a traitor, let's say, in the government, well, good luck finding that because it's Cuba. Counterintelligence here is very good, and they've already said that that's their plan. It's a very homogenous government here. It's not like Venezuela, where lots of people in the government were talking to the US intelligence agencies for months on end. That's not really conceivable in Cuba. The strategy for a long time has been to drive down living standards so much that people cannot bear it anymore and rise up to overthrow the government. Most of the people, the prominent dissidents, there never were very many, they've left to Miami because humans know that if you're a dissident, you get the golden parachute in the US. You know, it's a good way to make money. I'm not trying to say all dissidents are on the take, right? But there's a lot of it. And it's a great way to get across the border. There's been a lot of lying about, but when it comes to getting into the US, Cubans know that they historically have been privileged. And if you say that you're wanted by the authorities and that you've been in human rights protests, if you bullshit, then you're more likely to get let in than if you're Mexican. There's huge amounts of discontent, but there's no feeling on the street that if people rise up, the government's going to be overthrown. There's a feeling on the street that they'll be thrown in prison. They say the US says that negotiations are going on at the moment. Cuba says no. Nobody knows the truth of it. Lots of speculation. But you'd have to think, what would they be negotiating about? Because at least with Iran, they were negotiating about something, right? Like Iran's nuclear program. They had something that they could negotiate about, and they were negotiating about. Whereas it seems to me that the US is what wants surrender by this government. And this is a very nationalist country. And it doesn't seem to me that that's something that they're going to give up lightly. So who knows? But I think that military intervention is unlikely. And it's worth pointing out to those journalists and analysts and State Department people, just in case anyone listening, that take as a shibboleth, as just an axiomatic, that the regime is about to fall, teetering on collapse, that going back to the Eisenhower administration in 1960, they thought the same thing. And two-thirds of a century later, we're still here. Cuba's like this kind of boxer. You can hit and hit in the black eye as much as you want, and so that it can't even see, but you can't knock it down, at least until now. So we historically we've very much been here before, and very many
Right.
times when US policymakers of the day thought that the regime was about to fall.
Right. Well, Ed, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you sharing your insights with us. Good luck to you. Stay safe. My guest has been Ed Augustine. He's an independent journalist based in Havana, Cuba. His work has regularly been featured in the New York Times, Financial Times, NBC News, The Guardian, Al Jazeera, and more. And he recently had a documentary short out on how U.S. sanctions impact Cuba's healthcare system. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. Before figures like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Zohran Mamdani, or even for that matter, Barack Obama, appeared on the national stage, there was Reverend Jesse Jackson and his Rainbow Push Coalition, bringing together a broad-based, multiracial, progressive network of people and causes to the forefront of politics. Reverend Jackson, presidential candidate and legendary civil rights activist, passed away on February 17th at the age of 84. His legacy is rich with advocacy for the poor and people of color, for voting rights, education, health care, and workers' rights. He will lie in state in South Carolina, where he was from. Following that, his body will be transported to Chicago for a major celebration of life. Reverend Jackson spent the majority of his life in Chicago, where the Rainbow Push Coalition is headquartered. Joining me now to discuss the legacy of the late leader is Steve Phillips, national political leader, best-selling author, and columnist. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller Brown is the New White: How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority, and the national best-selling book How We Win the Civil War: Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. He is also a columnist for The Guardian and The Nation and the host of a podcast called Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. And of course, he's a founder of Democracy in Color, which is a political media organization. Steve, I've had you on for both of your past two books. It's a pleasure to have you on today to talk about Reverend Jackson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to have this conversation.
You were one of the first people I thought about when I thought about Reverend Jackson, given this legacy that he leaves behind, where he was really one of the first people, one of the first, of course, there were so many civil rights activists and leaders who did that, but he really was so prominent in bringing this idea of non-white Americans, people of color, across racial lines, joining together, uniting to make their agenda and to force it to be heard on a national political landscape. How much do you attribute your work to the legacy of Reverend Jackson?
All of it, right? And so yeah. Reverend Jackson was the single most important and formative force in terms of who I am and what I do. And I was 20 years old when he first ran for president in 1984, I served as a delegate. I was the statewide student coordinator for the Rainbow Coalition for the 1988 campaign. And the example that he provided and was just so powerful and compelling around what politics should be and where it should go. He was very much a direct bridge between the civil rights movement, somebody who was literally there at the time Dr. King was assassinated at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, and bringing that vision, those values, and probably most important, that coalition into the electoral political process in the 1980s in a fundamental fashion that both impacted politics, but also showed and illuminated the path forward for how to go about winning. This concept that when the old minorities come together, they comprise a new majority is, in essence, the coalition that elected Barack Obama and offers the greatest hope for the future of politics in this country.
Now, how did Reverend Jackson form this coalition? If you can give us a little bit of that history. The Rainbow Push Coalition was called that because it was the merging of two organizations or coalitions, right? The Rainbow and Push, right?
So Reverend Jackson worked with Martin Luther King in the 1960s, something called Operation Breadbasket, which is really about empowering people of color. After Dr. King was assassinated, he went and he created PUSH, which was People United to Serve Humanity. And that was his primary vehicle for much of the 70s leading to the early 80s. Then in 1984, when he ran for president, that vehicle, both conceptually and organizationally, was the Rainbow Coalition. And then after the 84 campaign, he merged those efforts into the Rainbow PUSH Coalition. And so that's the origin story and the etymology of how those different entities came together. And so that also reflects the direct connection back to the civil rights work, that movement, and most importantly, those leaders and organizations and constituencies that who had been part of the Rainbow Coalition, had been part of Dr. King's movement, the Poor People's Campaign, etc. Reverend built his political campaign on those foundations of those organizations that were there at the core of the civil rights movement, working with Dr. King.
As somebody who came from the civil rights movement and took the movement's ideals and demands onto the electoral stage, how did he compare to other figures? I'm thinking of Shirley Chisholm, for example. How much ground did he break in bringing the demands of the civil rights movement to a political electoral field? Because Dr. King's approach, of course, that was cut short by his assassination, but it was to pressure from the outside to force presidents to do the right thing, to force Congress to do the right thing. Jesse Jackson wanted to be not just pushing from the outside, but having a seat at the table, if not, you know, being the person in control.
Right. So Reverend Jackson famously said that the hands that once picked cotton can now pick presidents and governors and senators. And that distillation and that articulation reflected that coalition. And as well as he arrived at the really much of the swelling of the demographic revolution in the country. In the mid-1960s, when Dr. King was doing his work, the U.S. was about 12% people of color. Today, it's 41% people of color. So this concept of the people of color coming together with progressive whites comprising a majority is now much more empirically established, but nobody really believed it until Reverend Jackson ran in the 1980s. And then he demonstrated through his success, which is something that shouldn't be lost to history. And I really commend to people Abby Phillips' book on Reverend Jackson and what he actually did. First of all, when he first ran in 84, no one knew if he was going to, it was going to be an embarrassment, it was going to fall on his face and whatnot, but he did fairly well. He got 400 delegates. He had 3 million votes when he ran in 84. And then when he ran in 88, he got 1,200 delegates, 7 million votes, won 11 different states. And after the March primary in Michigan in 1988, Jesse Jackson was leading the presidential race, leading the Democratic nomination race. So, which really shook the party. Most fundamentally, it showed the political power and potential of this coalition. And that is the legacy, and that is the example that he has offered to the country. And that is the path that Obama followed in terms of that same coalition of people of color and progressive whites, proving that they are, in fact, a majority that can, in fact, have the hands that once picked cotton actually pick a president.
Did he really upend this notion of what political pundits like to claim is political viability?
Oh, 100%, that people didn't think that someone with that background who hadn't been a traditional elected official, et cetera, would have much viability.
And just black person being a politically viable in the position of president.
Oh, 100%. And so it's not accidental, that legacy and that impact around changing public perceptions. So Reverend Jackson in 1988 won the state of Virginia's primary, which then forced the entire state of Virginia to contemplate the concept of black men in charge. And so it's not an accident that after that happened, the following year, 1989, Doug Wilder became the first African-American governor of Virginia. So changing minds, expanding people's conception of what is possible is a very important and underappreciated aspect of Reverend's legacy. Mm-hmm.
He helped people realize that the impossible could be possible in a very real way. Of course, that mantra that he was so famous for, keep hope alive, was so central to that. I want to pivot to his legacy in as much as it can teach organizers today seeking to change our political system, what they can learn from what Reverend Jackson did. We are in such a dire, dire political situation today. The opposite of what Jackson wanted has come to pass. In many ways, of course, a backlash to his success and the success of others like him, where we have resurgent white supremacy and this real desire in the country among communities of color and progressive whites to see a change in 2026, 2028, and beyond. What lessons do you think can apply in terms of multiracial coalition building, grassroots organizing of voters?
So the most fundamental lesson, which is very critical for where we're going to go in 2026 and 2028, is are we going to continue the struggle and the quest and the movement for justice and equality within this country? And really, in many ways, it's even, Abraham Lincoln's pronouncement in the Gettysburg Address, the country rooted in the proposition that all are created equal. We do not have a presidential administration or direction which believes that they try to attack any efforts that are designed to promote equality and overcome inequality. And there's too much timidity and fear in the Democratic side and then among many progressives that pushing for equality and justice for all is a winning proposition. But what Reverend showed is that when you tap into that desire, that hunger, that quest, that belief in justice and equality in a society with everybody is included, it unleashes the kind of energy that brings more people into the process and actually helps you win. Most significantly, most recently, you have Mbandami in New York had a very similar formula. Speaking to the needs of a multiracial coalition, boosting turnout, increasing enthusiasm, and winning. And Reverend used to talk about, then we will win and deserve to win. That it would be a catastrophic mistake to abandon that struggle and the fear and the hope that somehow that's going to help us win, when that there is no evidence of that. Standing for justice, unapologetically pushing for equality and justice for all, and then organizing and mobilizing that coalition is the path to victory. It's the path that Reverend Jackson showed. It's the path that Barack Obama followed. And it's really what is going to be necessary to get us back to power in 2026 and 2028 and beyond.
Right. It's not just having a person of color in a position of power. It's combining the demand for justice, racial, economic, gender, all forms of justice, with that multiracial demographic at the base of it, which, as you pointed out, Mamdani has shown so effectively in New York City. And also there's such a thirst for among voters, right? The New York Times, and it's every now and then they will review or interview a bunch of potential voters. And very recently, the New York Times spoke with people who were either Democratic Party voters or once members of the Democratic Party. And every single person they talked to, down to the last one, said that in a future political candidate for president among the Democratic Party, they wanted somebody more progressive, not more centrist or more moderate. They wanted somebody further to the left of what they had been seeing. And so there really is such a thirst among voters for this. And so let me ask you finally to leave us with the question of, or answering the question of, what you think young people who may not have learned much about Jesse Jackson in school or wherever, where you think they should turn to learn more about his work. Are you pleased with the media obituaries, with their coverage of his legacy? Are there books? I mean, he, of course, has books himself and his speeches. Where can you point folks?
I would say two primary places where you can get good, accurate, connected information. So one is Abby Phillips' book on Reverend Jackson, the CNN anchor. She has done it's an incredible a book that captures the dynamics, the essence, the power, the potential of his life, of his political legacy, and of his movement. So in terms of a book, I would really point people in that direction. And then in terms of video, I would really commend to people Roland Martin's work over at Black Star Network and his retrospectives, the tributes that he's actually put forward. In many ways, he's carrying on the same legacy and tradition. And I think from a visual and video standpoint, his work is really capturing a lot of what Reverend's legacy was all about.
Thank you, Sonali Kohatkar, Gary Baca. This is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We break in because we only have a couple of days left in this fund drive, and we're asking you to go to your phone. If you appreciate this type of programming, if you appreciate KPFK's coverage about the war in Iran and many other things, 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. When people make a pledge to KPFK, a lot of them feel like they're doing it to pay off all the listening they've done in the past. You know who you are. Others who make a pledge do so to pay for their future listening. And some do it as a pure expression, a genuine random act of kindness to pay for someone else's listening, someone who isn't able to give now. Your support provides this service to everyone. Do a good deed and experience community radio karma. Call 818-985-5735 to pledge your support for this program and many other programs. If you have not pledged, go ahead, do it. Do it right now. Pick up that phone and hit 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. During this membership drive, you've heard us talk a lot about new members and how important they are to KPFK. That's because broadening the base of our support for KPFK is the fiscally responsible thing to do. The more people who support KPFK, the more stable our financial situation is, and the better able we are to withstand ups and downs in the economy. So if you've never contributed before, know that your new membership will help keep KPFK the reliable service that you and so many others depend on. 818-985-5735 is a number to pledge at any amount, maybe $100, $75, $500, $1,000, whatever you can afford. Call now. We do have the Jesse Jackson collection, a $100 donation, features 10 hours of audio from Jesse Jackson. 818-985-KPFK. If every single person who listened to KPFK every week contributed just a few dollars a year, we could pay for all the programs and the news you hear. More and more each day, our lives are affected by the events and people who live outside U.S. borders. We're covering Gaza. We're covering Iran and many other countries. Now more than ever, KPFK feels your need to stay connected to what's going on all over the world. You have access to voices all over the world, often in dangerous places, to bring new perspective to the issues of the day. Your membership helps pay for this kind of access and technology to bring it to you. Please make that important connection with us by calling right now or joining online, 818-985-5735, and call for a tote bag, T-shirt. Ask the phone room what we have in this last couple of days of the fund drive where we need you to get that pledge in. 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org.
I love KPFK. It's actually my favorite.